This is August 10th, 2008, and today I'm going to be reading from and commenting on an article from the New York Times of last year, actually, September 18th, 2007, about morality. And the title of the article is the following: Is Do Unto Others Written Into Our Genes? And this is by Nicholas Wade. And the reporter here reports on a series of articles and a book by a Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T. And the name of the book is The Happiness Hypothesis. And this Jonathan Haidt is a moral psychologist at the University of Virginia and has been constructing a broad evolutionary view of morality that traces its connections both to religion and to politics. Now I'll be reading straight from this. Dr. Haidt began his research career by probing the emotion of disgust, testing people's reactions to situations like that of a hungry family that cooked and ate its pet dog after it had become roadkill. He explored the phenomenon of moral dumbfounding. That's when people feel strongly that something is wrong but cannot explain why. Dumbfounding led him to view morality as driven by two separate mental systems, one ancient and one modern, though the mind is scarcely aware of the difference. The ancient system he calls moral intuition and is based on the emotion-laden moral behaviors that evolved before the development of language. The modern system, which he calls moral judgment, came after language, when people became able to articulate why something was right or wrong. Just to pause here, that what he's calling moral judgment is what it varies from culture to culture, whereas I would think he would agree that the difference with moral intuition, this deeper sense of what's right or wrong, is before, it's transcultural. Maybe not entirely, but mostly. So the difference between this ancient system of moral intuition and the more modern more recent moral judgment. I think of this famous saying in Zen, Zen is above morality, but morality is not below Zen. We don't want in Zen, we don't want to be going around and framing people and situations in terms of right and wrong. These are constructs that we've acquired through the socialization process, the acculturation process, and they're dependent on language. But then the second half of that, morality is not below Zen, means, of course, that we don't flaunt, we don't want to reject basic, fundamental moral precepts, because to do so is to betray our own nature, our own wisdom and our compassion, to cause harm to oneself and to others. That is, breaking the precepts is a way of would betray our true nature, because it goes against our nature to do that. He continues here, the emotional responses of moral intuition occur instantaneously. They are primitive gut reactions that evolved to generate split-second decisions and enhance survival in a dangerous world. Moral judgment, on the other hand, comes later, as the conscious mind develops a plausible rationalization for the decision already arrived at through moral intuition. Moral dumbfounding, in Dr. Haidt's view, occurs when moral judgment fails to come up with a convincing explanation for what moral intuition has decided. So, to use his example, eating the pet dog after it had been killed in the road, our rational mind says, well, yeah, you're hungry, you're poor, and there's meat, and you can nourish yourself with that. Why not? But then there is this revulsion to doing that, you know. But this also only goes so far, because in China, it's always been considered just fine to eat dogs. Maybe not your pet dog. I don't know about pet dogs. So then the author says, so why has evolution equipped the brain with two moral systems when just one might seem plenty? And then he quotes this Dr. Haidt. We have a complex animal mind that only recently evolved language and language-based reasoning. No way was control of the organism going to be handed over to this novel faculty. This novel faculty that was developed through the prefrontal cortex, our higher brain functions. He likens the mind's subterranean moral machinery, that is the moral intuition, to an elephant, and conscious moral reasoning to a small rider on the elephant's back. Psychologists and philosophers have long taken a far too narrow view of morality, he believes, because they have focused on the rider and largely ignored the elephant. Dr. Haidt developed a better sense of the elephant after visiting India at the suggestion of an anthropologist. While he was there, he saw that people recognized a much wider moral domain than the issues of harm and justice that are central to Western morality. Indians were concerned with integrating the community through rituals and committed to concepts of religious purity as a way to restrain behavior. And as we'll hear, the ordination ceremony that we'll have later this morning will be an example of this integrating the community through rituals and ceremonies, and also to commitment to religious purity. On his return from India, Dr. Haidt combed the literature of anthropology and psychology for ideas about morality throughout the world. He identified five components of morality that were common to most cultures. Some concerned the protection of individuals, others the ties that bind a group together. Of the moral systems that protect individuals, one is concerned with preventing harm to the person, and the other with reciprocity and fairness. Less familiar are the three systems that promote behaviors developed for strengthening the group. These are loyalty to the in-group, respect for authority and hierarchy, and a sense of purity or sanctity. Now we're getting into the meat of this article. So the first two, these five components of morality, or these five moral systems that most cultures have in common, two of them are about the individual, preventing harm to the person, and reciprocity or fairness, and the other three are more for preserving the group. Loyalty, respect for authority, and a sense of purity or sanctity. The five moral systems are innate psychological mechanisms that predispose children to absorb certain virtues. Because these virtues are learned, so we're still here on the level of moral judgment, not the moral intuition. Because these virtues are learned, morality may vary widely from culture to culture while maintaining its central role of restraining selfishness. In Western societies, the focus is on protecting individuals by insisting that everyone be treated fairly. Creativity is high, but society is less orderly. In many other societies, selfishness is suppressed through practices, rituals, and stories that help a person play a cooperative role in a larger social entity. And this is, I'm sure he would say, as I would, that this is one of the big differences between East and West. In West, there's much greater emphasis on individual welfare, fairness, and rights. And in Asia, traditionally and largely still today, though a little less so, the emphasis rather on the individual is on social order and the group and hierarchy. We have here the challenge of transplanting an Asian tradition into the West, a Western culture, and it's something that is still definitely a work in progress in terms of finding how this Asian tradition can work with Americans. He goes on, the idea that morality and sacredness are intertwined may now be out of fashion, but has a venerable pedigree, tracing back to Emile Durkheim, a founder of sociology. Dr. Haidt believes that religion has played an important role in human evolution by strengthening and extending the cohesion provided by the moral systems. And then they quote him, if we didn't have religious minds, we would not have stepped through the transition to groupishness, he said. We'd still be just small bands roving around. Religious behavior may be the result of natural selection, in his view, shaped at a time when early human groups were competing with one another. Those who found ways to bind themselves together were more successful, he said. Now I'm going to pause here and, first of all, distinguish between religion and spirituality. Spirituality, of course, as we all know, can take many forms. It doesn't have to be religion. I think as a child, I absorbed actually quite a strong sense of spirituality in a kind of a undefined way, but had no religious, no exposure to religion. We know that there are people with a strong sense of integrity and moral development who are not religious. They have no religion. Just as we know there are plenty of people who are consider themselves very religious who are real vile. Religion, as compared to spirituality, religion implies structure. The word religion comes from a root word, religare, which means to bind together. And in Buddhism, historically, it was a religion of monasticism, that monks and nuns lived in communities with many articulated rules, monastic rules and regulations that formed the kind of the spine of the community, the bones of the community. And we know here that in Buddhism and in Zen, as well as Buddhism more generally, we have these three elements, these three essentials of Buddhist practice, which one of which is morality. The other two are meditation and wisdom. These are this is the tripod that stabilizes this whole practice, not just the religion, but the practice that we need to fortify the practice of meditation with upright conduct, and as well as, ideally, as the wisdom that comes from experience in practice. And the two most important ceremonies we have in Zen consist primarily of the 16 precepts. One is what we call Jukai, the formal receiving of these 16 precepts, and the other is ordination. And the main distinction between the ordination ceremony and the ordinary Jukai that we have twice a year is that in ordination there is this additional vow that I will dedicate my life to the Dharma. So it's an occupational commitment. This is what I'm going to do. This is going to be my path. And I will, unless circumstances prevent me temporarily from doing this full time, I will be doing it full time. It's an occupational commitment. At least at this center, it's actually not in most Zen centers. Most Zen centers, they're sort of conflated. You take Jukai and thereby become a priest or something like that. But then as a priest, you can go on, repairing computers or selling shoes or whatever you want to do, practicing psychotherapy or whatever you want to do. But I always felt, as did Roshi Kaplow, that it really gives it gives an institutional fiber to have ordination be to rest on an occupational commitment, that it is, other people come and go, we know this happens all the time, and to be fair, even some people who have been ordained in the past then disrobed and withdrew from the order, but by and large the idea is that with people who become priests, ordained priests at this center, they can be counted on, if not to stay here at this center as a resource, then to stick to the business of committing themselves to the Dharma full time. So of course we have people who were priests here and remain priests, but as teachers went elsewhere, and actually that is, to become ordained does not require that you stay at this center, even if you're not a teacher. Obviously, if you become a teacher and you go and start your own sangha, that's perfectly okay, more than okay. But even if you're not a teacher, The ordination really means a commitment to the Dharma and not to this center in particular. Although, most ordained people don't become teachers. They never have. Most ordained people stay at one monastery or temple or center like this, or maybe, you know, one or two different ones, but that's the thing. Now, I find to my amazement that people, I guess mostly new people, are still unclear of the distinction between being ordained as a priest, which is what we'll have today, and being sanctioned or authorized as a teacher. There's really no real connection. There are priests who never become teachers. We certainly see this. That's the rule in Asia, in our tradition. And there are also teachers who never become ordained. You become a teacher without being ordained. We have what we call the Three Jewels Order here. And I started this some years ago, long after I had been ordaining priests. I came to feel that there are experienced people in the Sangha, senior, very serious people in the Sangha, who couldn't or wouldn't ever become ordained as priests. And I felt that I wanted to create an order of such, a way to recognize the serious aspiration of such people and their great service to the center. And so I expanded I added this other element. Instead of just ordained priests, now we have these lay members of the Three Jewels Order. So there are two populations in the Three Jewels Order, the ordained priests and those who have been invested as lay members of the Three Jewels Order, which requires, just for starters, that you have been a member here for at least 7 years before you can become a lay member or a priest of the order. The word order is one that we know, and that it's been used and continues to be used in other major religions besides Buddhism. And I think the word order is a very revealing word, because I see it as really providing the basis of order in the Sangha. One of the many definitions I found in the dictionary of order is a state of peace and serenity, observance of the law, orderly conduct. The original meaning of Sangha, for those of you who are new, Sangha just means the community of practitioners. So the Rochester Zen Center Sangha, the Toronto Zen Center Sangha, and so forth. And it really means community. And it rests on order, of course. You can't have a community without order. You can't have a society without order. And going back to our five components of morality, our five moral systems, three of them emphasize this sense of order, which we should always remember. It really means, or ideally, at its best, order means peace and serenity, the common good. back to Asia, this element, these three of order and a common good, are have always been emphasized more than individual rights. We see this in China, where they cannot begin to understand why we get so worked up about violation of human rights, a violation of the Tibetans' rights and other individual rights, and they get furious when we preach to them about human rights. Human rights are not something that we need to ever de-emphasize in this country. But I think it's very useful to consider, to understand, as a way of understanding the difference there, understanding the Chinese position. And we always want to understand the other. Those with whom we disagree, still, we don't have to agree with them. We don't have to follow their way, but who would not want to understand better where they're coming from? And that, I think, is something that's self-evident, that they see that when the two clash, individual rights and liberties and social order and cohesion, that the latter has to be given priority. Back to the Three Jewels Order, and in particular, ordination as a priest. It really is, in becoming ordained as a priest, you are giving up some minor individual rights for the sake of conserving or preserving the community. When we become ordained as priests, we just have a convention that we've worked up where we keep our hair short in Tibet, at least. Maybe this is also true in other Asian countries. In Tibet, short means actually not that short. It means no longer than the width of two fingers. So that's about an inch and a half, actually. In Japan, they're very strict about keeping clean shaven. Every 5 days, you shave your head glossy, clean, like as we do with our faces. But that's only Japan. When I was in China and Tibet, Taiwan, they're not so strict about keeping it clean shaven all the time. In this country, there are Zen centers where priests are strict. They follow the Japanese. Most Zen centers in the United States come from Japanese lineages. And they're very strict about keeping the head shaved, glossy, clean. And usually at those same centers, which is most Zen centers, they use the word monk very loosely. What we call a priest, an ordained priest, in most centers, they would call monks. I had the strange experience in our annual Zen teachers meeting 2 weeks ago of sitting next to one of the teachers with his gleaming head. Refer to himself as a monk, and this is a guy who's not only married but has three kids, and this has become the norm in the United States to refer to people who are ordained as monks even though they have families, and it kind of drives me crazy, primarily because it blurs the distinction between the traditional bhikshus, that is, celibate monks who've left home. Homeless ones is the literal translation from the Chinese. I think it diminishes their commitment. What do we think that celibate monks think of these family men referring to themselves as monks? I think it's done. I'm sure it's done partly, this overuse of the word monk. It's done partly to inflate their status, and because in the Buddhist world, monk sounds more serious and more hardcore, and you can create this this image of serious celibate training, and have your cake and eat it too. You get to also have the joys of family life, but I think it's a real mistake. I'm a little embarrassed. I would be certainly in a meeting of that included these Chinese or Japanese. Chinese or Korean celibate monks, I would be embarrassed to hear anyone, any family man call himself a monk, and I can't imagine that they think very favorably of it. So, we're going to keep the word priest. You know, it's only, I don't know about only, but primarily in Catholicism that the word priest means celibate. But if you look at the broad length of human history and across religions, what is translated in English as priest usually did not mean vows of celibacy, and it doesn't here either. We tried that in the early 70s. Roshi Kapila wanted to preserve the original rigor of ordaining only people, only celibate monks, and the three people who took that path, four members of the center who were ordained as celibate monks, all withdrew. To be fair, it's hard in a sangha that is 99% lay to maintain one's celibate commitment. And yeah, so in becoming ordained, even as priests, not monks, we keep to this thing about hair length as a way of keeping things simple. If your hair is really short, you're less likely to spend much time grooming, running a comb through your hair, certainly. And it's a way to not eliminate vanity, of course, but to free oneself a little bit more from our tendency toward vanity. In clothes, we went through a process of figuring out how we could wear clothes that distinguish us and broadcast our commitment, our lifelong commitment, and we came up with, as a color, wearing navy or other blue color, and then more formally, and then less formally, sometimes to wear gray or black. So those three colors primarily. I learned while in Japan that the monks in the monastery priests, because in Japan you don't have to take vows of celibacy when you're ordained. That's we've adopted the Japanese system. That in Japan the priests would often just around the temple wear their underrobe tops, the white underrobe tops. So we have sort of relaxed about that a little bit. And as far as a style of clothing, when dressing more formally for more formal occasions, we have adopted this custom of wearing a shirts with a banded collar. It is not a conventional collar, but the other kinds, like a narrow type collar, but can be much narrower collar than the big, high, narrow collar. So we've given up these little things of hair, choice in hair length and clothes, and choice in occupation. And all of this, theoretically, this is all done to subordinate ourselves, that is, us priests, subordinate ourselves to the order, the Three Jewels Order, or to, we could say, what that really means is subordinate ourselves to a greater order, in order that peace and serenity and stability can more easily prevail in our Buddhist community. It's a way of conserving or preserving the Dharma. The Dharma can be understood in two ways, in the relative sense and in the essential sense. In the essential sense, the essential Dharma doesn't need preserving. The essential Dharma, here's the essential Dharma. or drinking a glass of water, or pushing your kid on the swings. It's all Dharma from the essential perspective. You can't get outside the Dharma. The Dharma just means the law or the truth. So from the essential perspective, there's no need to do, you don't even need to sit. You're just born in the Dharma. Birth itself is the Dharma, as is death. But from the other side, Dharma can mean more in a relative sense. It can mean this teaching. This teaching of oneness, this teaching of wisdom and compassion and virtue that is our nature, and everything about this specific Buddhist teaching that is, you can call the Dharma. And that ordination is a way to preserve that, to extend it across generations. In other words, it's an institutional commitment. Committing to the institution of Buddhism as an institution. Abbots are fundamentally conservative. The job of an abbot of a temple or a center like this is to preserve the temple without compromising the Dharma in the wider sense, the truth. We know that it can go too far. We know from other religions that the preserving institution can be at the price of the original essence of the religion. That's part of the job of the abbot, to not let that happen. But you don't need to ignore the institution of the Dharma, this relative Dharma, in order to preserve the essence of it. Now I'm going to pick back up in this article. Dr. Haidt came to recognize the importance of religion by a roundabout route. I first found divinity in disgust, he writes in his book, The Happiness Hypothesis. The emotion of disgust probably evolved when people became meat-eaters and had to learn which foods might be contaminated with bacteria, a problem not presented by plant foods, let it be noted. Disgust was then extended to many other categories, to people who were unclean, to unacceptable sexual practices, and to a wide class of bodily functions and behaviors that were seen as separating humans from animals. And then they quote Haidt. This Dr. Haidt is saying, imagine visiting a town where people wear no clothes, never bathe, have sex doggy style in public, and eat raw meat by biting off pieces directly from the carcass. He sees the disgust evoked by such a scene as allied to notions of physical and religious purity. Purity is, in his view, a moral system that promotes the goals of controlling selfish desires and acting in a religiously approved way. So note the contrast between this fanciful, extreme scene and what we're calling order, peace and serenity. Working with a graduate student, Dr. Haidt has detected a striking political dimension to morality. He asked people to identify their position on a liberal-conservative spectrum and then complete a questionnaire that assessed the importance attached to each of the five moral systems. They found that people who identified themselves as liberals attached great weight to the two moral systems protective of individuals. But liberals assigned much less importance to the three moral systems that protect the group, those of loyalty, respect for authority, and purity. Conservatives placed value on all five moral systems, but they assigned less weight than liberals to the moralities protective of individuals. Dr. Haidt believes that many political disagreements between liberals and conservatives may reflect the different emphasis each places on the five moral categories. Take attitudes to contemporary art and music. Conservatives fear that subversive art will undermine authority, violate the in-group's traditions, and offend canons of purity and sanctity. Liberals, on the other hand, see contemporary art as protecting equality by assailing the establishment, especially if the art is by oppressed groups. Extreme liberals, he argues, attach almost no importance to the moral systems that protect the group. So anarchists say. Because conservatives do give some weight to individual protections, they often have a better understanding of liberal views than liberals do of conservative attitudes, in his view. I found this really fascinating and wonderful in the sense that it helps me understand, sympathize or empathize more with those on the right-hand end of the political spectrum. You know, Buddha nature is beyond liberal and conservative. We're all, in our fundamental nature, we are all enlightened. And so if we find ourselves frequently critical, either speaking critically or thinking critically of the other side of the political spectrum, we got a problem. We're missing something. We can, of course, find fault with certain positions, and especially the more extreme positions on either end. But can we not maybe now appreciate the good intentions that those on the other end of the spectrum have? I've always felt that I'm somewhat socially conservative. I see great harm done by all the trash that's available on the media. I understand that, those who want to restrict what's available more than it is now. Dr. Haidt, who describes himself as a moderate liberal, says that societies need people with both types of personality. He says, a liberal morality will encourage much greater creativity, but will weaken social structure and deplete social capital. I am really glad we have New York and San Francisco. Most of our creativity comes out of cities like these. But a nation that was just New York and San Francisco could not survive very long. Conservatives give more to charity. Hear that? Conservatives give more to charity and tend to be more supportive of essential institutions like the military and law enforcement. And I would say that there is a natural resonance between a more conservative outlook on life, maybe not just politics, outlook on life, and an order such as the Three Jewels Order, much less a monastic community. Again, an order, a religious order, is a way of conserving or preserving the teaching. And then he cites other psychologists who agree or disagree with his ideas. Steven Pinker, the cognitive scientist at Harvard, who's written a couple of big books, said he's a big fan of Haidt's work. Another guy by the name of DeWall, a primatologist, said he disagreed with Haidt's view that the task of morality is to suppress selfishness. For me, he says, the moral system is one that resolves the tension between individual and group interests in a way that seems best for the most members of the group. And hence, it promotes a give and take. He said that he also disagreed with Dr. Haidt's alignment of liberals with individual rights and conservatives with social cohesiveness. He says, it is obvious that liberals emphasize the common good, safety laws for coal mines, health care for all, support for the poor, that are not nearly as well recognized by conservatives. Now, what This last sentence here, again, Dr. Haidt, it is at least possible that conservatives and traditional societies have some moral or sociological insights that secular liberals do not understand. Asia is still stamped with the ethos of Confucianism. And there's no more social, no more conservative major philosophy or system than Confucianism. It's based on hierarchy, on order. And this, by the way, is I've read over and over again, is the number one fear of the Chinese. Disorder, social chaos, civil war. Because they have a long history, thousands of years of civil war. So they will place this as a much higher priority than we do. You look at the issues that divide political issues that divide liberals and conservatives, and you can appreciate this whole thesis. Look at immigration. People on the left would tend more to see undocumented aliens as disruptive of social order, the opposite of seeing them as just their natural, assuming their natural rights as individuals, whereas those on the right would see it as disruptive of social order. Freedom of media expression, freedom of speech, same thing. Flag burning, look at that old issue. Liberals would tend to see it as a perfectly valid individual right. Why shouldn't we be able to burn a flag? Whereas conservatives would more likely tend to see it as indicative of a threat to social order, patriotism, and other things. Another way it could be understood is the difference between placing as a value independence versus interdependence. We all, those of you who know much about Buddhism, know that interdependence is a key word. Can liberals appreciate the conservative side as more supportive of interdependence, and conservatives appreciate the liberal side as more appreciative of independence? All right. There was more, but we'll have to stop now and get out and do the ordination. We'll now recite the four vows.